Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us by phone on the second half of the show is Dr. Enric Sala. He is a full-time conservationist as a National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and he's here to talk about a new book that he authored called The Nature of Nature, and it talks about Pacific kelp forest off the coast of California and some of the challenges, we'll put it that way, some of the challenges they are facing in their survival and the role they play, important role they play in ecological systems in writ large off the Pacific coast. Dr. Sala, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start here. You know, we're in Park City, Dr. Sala. We're, what, 1,000 miles inland and 7,000 feet up in the air. But as I was talking to my co-host Nell, we were saying, I bet Park City benefits from Pacific kelp forest in one way or another, and we'll get to that eventually. But give us a little background on what a kelp forest looks like, what it feels like, and how much of it covers the Pacific coast.
Sure. There is one species of kelp that is called the giant kelp that is very abundant on the coast of California, the Pacific Northwest. And the giant kelp is like the redwoods of the sea. You are at the bottom of the ocean, maybe you are 60, 90 foot deep, and there is this holdfast, looks like a cone. It's a mesh of stems, thick as your little finger, that go up like the trunk of a tree. And every stipe is dotted with bladders that are filled with gas, about the size of large olives, which are crowned by leaf-like blades. And when these stipes reach the surface, the giant kelp continues to grow, creating a canopy atop the water surface. So you are down there, you see these dozens of stipes growing up, one kelp plant here, another there. It's like you are under the canopy of the forest, and you can see the sunlight filtering through the canopy as if through the stained glass of a cathedral. This is what the kelp forest looks like. This is what the kelp forest feels like. For those of who are not divers, who haven't had the enormous privilege to dive in a kelp forest.
It sounds like an incredible experience that we can only imagine through your description. Tell us a little bit about why, you know, in addition to kind of this natural beauty and this special ecosystem, why is it important? Why are these kelp forests important?
Right. Giant kelp forests are important for several reasons. One, they are like the forest, the trees of a forest on the land that provides the habitat for hundreds, if not thousands of species. We have areas on the California coast, and we can talk about that later, without kelps, and the diversity of life is severely reduced. Also, kelps are plants that grow really fast. If you are patient enough, you can even see them growing yourself. They can grow up to a foot and a half a day.
Wow.
By doing so, they capture a lot of carbon from the water. So kelp forests, like the forests on the land, are helping us to absorb much of our carbon pollution and help to mitigate climate change. By doing so, also, they produce oxygen that helps to fill the atmosphere with much-needed gas that we need for our survival. Also, kelp forests have the ability also to, with these canopies, to attenuate the power of waves. And so when the waves reach the coast after they have been through the kelp forest, they have much lower energy. They are less damaging. And so these are some of the services that the kelp forest provides for people.
Do they also serve as a nursery for juvenile and adolescent sea creatures as a form of protection for them?
Absolutely. There are many species of fish that can grow only in kelp forests. They are a nursery for many species of fish. They are also the habitat for larger fish that go after the little fish that are in the nursery. So the kelp forests contain an entire ecosystem from small to large species.
What was estimated range over, you know, decades or centuries ago? Was any sense of that they covered a much larger span area of the sea than they do now?
Yes, in the past, kelp forests were very abundant from about half of the peninsula of Baja California all the way to Washington State. And also we can find kelp forests in the southern tip of South America, giant kelp forests. But in the last decade, the extent of kelp forests have been reduced because of two major threats. One is population explosions of sea urchins that eat everything that all the plants that grow on the sea. They can turn a kelp forest, a vibrant, healthy kelp forest, into a barren ground. Hmm. The second one is ocean warming caused by climate change. Kelps are cold water plants. They don't do well when the water gets warm. And we have these episodes of ocean warming during El Nino years, where the water gets warmer than usual for too long, and the kelp plants look really bad and just wither and die.
What is it that is promoting the growth of sea urchins? Is there, what is the relationships in there? Are we seeing more sea urchins that result in less kelp, or is it the fact that maybe there's less kelp and there's few predators on the sea urchins? How is all of that linkage going on?
As you said, it's all linked. It's all linked and interdependent. And the kelp forests are a great example of how human activities, human exploitation of nature has many unintended consequences that we couldn't predict in the past. So let's start with the sea urchins. Sea urchins love to eat kelp. So when you have lots of sea urchins, they eat everything. But who eats sea urchins? There is a big fish called the sheephead that likes to eat sea urchins of a certain size, not too big. There is another big predator of sea urchins, is the sea otter. The sea otter was a very abundant animal before the trappers, mostly Russians in the late 18th and 19th centuries, starting hunting them industrially for their pelts. So when you remove the predator from the kelp forest, when the sea otter is gone, when the big sheephead has been depleted by overfishing, then the sea urchins don't have any predator left. So when you don't have a predator, your populations grow. In the case of sea urchins, their populations explode because every little urchin can produce tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of eggs. So their replenishment capabilities are really, really high. So you remove the predator and the sea urchin explodes. They eat the kelp and all the species, most of the species that live within the kelp forest then are gone.
Do we know, you know, how to address these issues? Of course, that's where our minds go next. And, you know, sea warming due to climate change is a huge issue. But with the removal of these predators, is there a way to manage for, you know, a healthy sea otter population or the fish population?
There are definitely ways. So for the ocean warming, there is only one solution, which is phase off fossil fuels, shift to a renewable energy economy. It's our emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases that produces the warming of the atmosphere and the ocean. So there is no other solution to reverse ocean warming than that. But there are things that we can do today that will start having an impact tomorrow. And that includes the creation of no-take marine reserves, areas where no fishing, no extractive activities are allowed. And in these places, if they are well managed, marine life comes back spectacularly. I've seen it with my own eyes. Places that were degraded, once they are protected, nobody fishes there. Marine life recovers spectacularly, including the return of the large predators, the large fish. Mm. There have been also efforts to reintroduce sea otter to part of their natural range. And sea otters have been coming farther south along the California coast. And also there is another management action that can be carried out in many places, which is sea urchin fishery. Sea urchin roe, the uni that people like to eat in sushi, it's a delicacy. So a selective sea urchin fishery in some areas we could have commercial benefit, but also it would have the ecological benefit of allowing the kelp forest to come back. Wow. But there is no silver bullet, right? We're talking about the silver gunshot.
No,
right.
You're right.
We're speaking silver buckshot.
Yeah. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Enric Sala. He is a National Geographic explorer in residence and author of the forthcoming book, The Nature of Nature, which, among other things, talks about Pacific kelp forests, which are often referred to as the redwoods of the sea. So, so many, like you say, Dr. Sala, so many interlinking connections that the success of one species depends on the presence and success of other species. So we can introduce more sea otters to an area, but maybe sea otters also are impacted by warmer waters and climate change too. They prefer certain temperatures and certain salinity and certain conditions as well, right?
Yes, ocean warming and acidification, climate change is really a global threat that is impacting everything else.
Yeah.
It acts in synergy with everything else. So what can we do? What we can do is to make local habitats, local ecosystems more resilient. As we discussed before, we need to reduce our carbon emissions, and that's going to take a long time. And reversing ocean warming is going to take a long time. But we can buy time by protecting as much of the critical places in the ocean as we can to make sure that marine life recovers as much as possible within the current environment. So these places are more resilient. They have the diversity, they have the redundancy, they have the resilience that they need to be able to survive in a world of increased warming.
So going back to the economic benefits, you know, man benefits, not just, you know, marine species benefit from an expanded or a healthy kelp forest, but man benefits too. As you say, not only is it a nursery for juvenile and adolescent fish, but it's also home for adult fish that feed on them. There is a thriving system that includes fish or marine species that man can harvest sustainably. That's probably a critical term too. So talk a little bit about the value that we get from kelp forests, as long as it's in a sustainable way.
Yes, kelp forests, like any other nursery, like it could be a mangrove forest or a seagrass bed.
Mm-hmm.
These places where that are the habitats where the babies of many species of fish grow are key to ensure the replenishment of these species. Kelp forests are the nurseries of coastal fish that then can be caught elsewhere. And if we continue over, we are reducing the ability of the ocean to self-replenish. We are reducing the ability of these species of fish and invertebrates to self-replenish. So we need to give them some refuges. In addition to having kelp forests where they can grow, we need to have protected kelp forests where there is no fishing at all, so these species can grow. And studies from around the world, doing our own research, shows that when you protect an area, being a kelp forest, a coral reef, a seagrass bed, a sandy bottom, whatever it is, when we protect an area fully protected from fishing and other extractive activities, the abundance of fish increases by 6 times on average.
Six times.
Relative to unprotected areas nearby. And not only the fish are more abundant, they are also larger. On average, they are a third larger than outside these protected areas. And this is the what I like to use, a financial analogy. These protected areas, these fully protected kelp forests, are like investment accounts with a principal that we set aside that produces compound interest at 6 times, that 600% increase, that's the compound interest. And the fish, when they grow larger, they produce a disproportionately larger number of eggs, which help to replenish the areas around. So these investment accounts, these marine reserves are investment accounts that produce returns that people can enjoy. A place, a coast, without these marine reserves is like a debit account where everybody withdraws and nobody makes a deposit. Mm. You don't need to be an economist to know what's going to happen to that account.
It sounds like an incredibly productive habitat or ecosystem.
Very productive. Yeah, the kelp forest is one of the largest, the fastest growing plants on the planet, land or sea. But also the ocean in general has an extraordinary ability to bounce back if we just give it some space.
So one of the other pieces that you mentioned earlier in the interview about these kelp forests is that they help to kind of attenuate the power of waves. And one thing we know about climate change is that, you know, one of its impacts is an increased intensity of storms. So could kelp forests also kind of help us maybe mitigate the impacts of these storms?
Absolutely. They act like a living, dynamic wave breaker. Mm. Kelp forests do that, growing thriving coral reefs do that, mangrove forests do that. All seagrass beds also help to, with the roots, the seagrasses help to fix the sediment, which also contributes to the stability of beaches and helps to avoid having to refill beaches with sand in the summer, right, because of the storm wave power. So this, if we have sandy beaches, if we have beautiful areas where people have been building, it's because all these living ecosystems have been providing the conditions for these nice, beautiful beaches. Right? And it is our destroying of these ecosystems that reduces that natural insurance. You know, kelp forests and other natural ecosystems are like an insurance policy.
Are we seeing states along the Pacific coast, so it's just going to be Washington, Oregon, California, are state governments enacting any types of policies or incentives to protect these kelp forests?
There are protections all along the Pacific coast of the United States and Canada. However, a high level of protection is minimal. It's very, very small. Less than 1% of the coast of the United States, the continental coast, is fully protected. But the science is telling us that if we are to preserve marine life, if we are to prevent the extinction of species, if we are to prevent the collapse of a critical part of our life support system, if we want the ocean life to continue helping us absorbing much of our carbon pollution, helping us to mitigate climate change, we need half of the ocean in natural state. And we can start by committing all of the countries of the world to protect at least 30% of the ocean by 2030. And in the United States, there is an initiative called 30 by 30. And Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico and other senators submitted a resolution a few months ago calling for a national target for 30% of the U.S. land and waters protected by 2030.
Right. Well, unfortunately, if I got my facts right, we also saw the president go to Maine a couple weeks ago, where he announced that otherwise protected area, was now going to be reopened to certain fisheries, et cetera. So on a federal level, we have a challenge confronting us. That's why I asked about maybe the states are doing something, and perhaps businesses themselves, some of the fishing industry may be participating in at least trying to cut back on over-harvesting practices.
Yeah, it's a tricky business.
Yes.
There are states like California. California has a Marine Life Protection Act that created more than a decade ago a system of protected areas along the coast of California covering almost 20% of the coast. And these areas are yielding phenomenal results. The abundance of marine life within these reserves has increased spectacularly. And the local fishermen are actually benefiting from the replenishment, from the returns that these areas produce. What the President Trump did in May was something that many scholars believe it's illegal. And I believe it's illogical, and economically it doesn't make sense. That was the only marine national monument in the continental United States. And now if the proclamation that President Trump signed survives the court cases, will allow commercial fishing within the only marine national monument in the Atlantic. Which means this would be similar to opening Yellowstone or Yosemite national parks to industrial hunting. And this is not the only problem. The United States is one of the countries in the world with the best fisheries management. There was a goal under President Obama's administration to end overfishing, to ensure that we are not taking fish faster than they can reproduce. Mm-hmm. And we have examples of over 20 fish species that are rebounding thanks to strict measures, thanks to stricter quotas, thanks to better controls. However, these are exceptions, because in many places around the world, most of the fishing around the world is on a downward trend. And some lobster fishermen in Maine were very happy to see the opening of the Marine National Monument to fishing, even though most of them fish much closer to shore. But the problem, there are two problems for the lobster fishermen. One is overfishing, and the other one is ocean warming. The ocean, the Gulf of Maine, is warming faster than the average of the ocean. So the lobsters are migrating north. Mm. They are moving towards Nova Scotia. Same thing happened farther south in New England. So So it is the policies that perpetuate global warming that are hurting the fishermen, not a monument. And this is something that we're seeing everywhere around the world. Two-thirds of the fish stocks are experiencing overfishing. We reached peak fish 24 years ago. So the worst enemy of fishing is overfishing, not protected areas. These marine reserves, these protected areas in the ocean, are absolutely essential to ensure not only the viability of these unique ecosystems with all the species that live in them, but also to ensure the viability of our use of the ocean into the future.
Right.
Well, we've got just a couple minutes left, and I want to take time to ask about your upcoming book, The Nature of Nature, that'll be released later this summer. Will you give us a quick preview of that?
Yeah, The Nature of Nature is a book that was in my mind for 30 years, or as long as I've been conducting scientific research and diving around the world. It is my way of showing why we need the wild, why we need to protect more than 30% of the land and the ocean, why it makes sense from a utilitarian perspective for our own survival, why it makes sense economically. And now I was able to write a final chapter when the book was almost going to the printer on the coronavirus, on the nature of the coronavirus. Because what we're suffering now, this global crisis with all these deaths and economic downturn and people losing their jobs, the cost, the ultimate cost of this is our broken relationship with nature. In this case, it was a virus that jumped from a wild animal to a person. In the past, we have similar viruses, SARS, MERS, Ebola, HIV, and others. And it is our destroying natural ecosystems. It is our destroying forests on the land and degrading ocean ecosystems that is increasing the risk for humans to acquire these diseases. So this is my book is, I would say, it's like a love letter to the planet. It's trying to share all I have learned over 30 years of research on how nature works and why we cannot expect that removing pieces, parts of it, is going to result in no change. We need to preserve our life support system with all its parts, even if we don't know what most of those parts do.
Dr. Enric Sala, he's a National Geographic explorer in residence and author of the forthcoming book, The Nature of Nature. And Dr. Sala, real quick, do you have a website that people can go to learn more about you and your work?
Yes, we have a website on our National Geographic Pristine Seas project. So if you go to pristineseas.org, pristineseas.org, and you will find information about our work at National Geographic to help protect the wildest places in the ocean.
Perfect. Well, thank you again for taking the time to chat with us this morning, Dr. Sala.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's take a break.